Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, this is Dr. John back with another episode of the Evolved Caveman. And today it's my pleasure to have with me Ellie Weinstein. And Ellie is a therapist who is joining us all the way from New York City, 3,000 miles away. It's crazy what technology can do. So Ellie is a guy that I've spoken with and really, really like. He's the founder of Elevation.org, and he also just came out with a new podcast called The Dude Therapist. So you know we're going to hit it off. Ellie, how you doing? Good to see you.
I'm doing great. I'm actually secretly hiding in California during Corona. You know, just why not deal with it in the fun, the sun a little bit, you know? Why not?
That's right. Good.
I'm glad
you're getting your vitamin D out here.
There's no other way of doing it. I'm not popping those vitamin D pills. I got to get it from the source. I'm organic that way, you know?
Excellent. And congratulations on just submitting your LCSW paperwork. That's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you. It's super exciting to like finally feel like you're progressing in your career that you're working so hard for. So it's a nice like a validation.
Yeah. And for those of you who don't know, that's a master's in social work that you have to do. Are you sure 3,000 hours?
It's 2,000 hours, 3 years. Maybe I was grandfathered into that older rule.
Oh, I think now it's changed.
So lucky me. It just means, you know, just getting the experience and becoming as seasoned and as rounded as possible.
Yeah. So you have to do a ton of hours, usually in a clinic somewhere that's a public clinic where this never made sense to me. Like you seem to get the worst, the most difficult, the most challenging cases when you know very little when you're starting out your career. And then as you move forward, you tend to get easier cases when you're more seasoned.
Isn't that funny? I don't think you put it that way and just put into those terms. It's kind of weird that as you get, you know, you look at some degrees or some fields at the heart, the older, more seasoned you get, the harder cases you take because, well, he's the best. He's been doing it for years. But as, you know, private therapists, it's like, oh, my caseload's like, I don't know, 20 people. And I see 3-4 people a day and it's pretty chill. But it's right. You know, as a community clinic that I work at in New York, you see everyone and everything. It's pretty intense, but not everyone's like that. You know, you have the gamut of people from, I see people from ages 8 to like 70 something dealing with self-esteem to the most severe as is schizophrenia. So you just have these really interesting days where you have these really flow, easy kind of quote unquote therapy sessions. And then you have these really intense therapy sessions where you might have to call 911. So just like this very interesting mix that kind of keeps you on your toes and really trains you to be the best therapist as you can when it comes to taking care of yourself and stuff.
It trains you to be calm when the wheels are just falling off.
Yeah. You know, sometimes, and I'll say this here, you know, as honest as I can be, sometimes I don't know what I'm doing. Sometimes I'm getting thrown things that I've never dealt with or not in my wheelhouse or something that makes me truly uncomfortable. But because of the intense experiences, whether I spent some time in my internship in a psych hospital, interning for like about 10 months working in a psych unit. And even now working in this really fast paced, seeing so many clients in a day, it kind of really helps you kind of make you strong to deal with when things go kind of hit the fan. And you're also able to kind of keep your head on straight when stuff doesn't seem to go as planned, which nothing does, but it's just really helpful when you're actually dealing with human beings and you need to kind of keep your head on straight.
Yeah. The system never made that much sense to me in that regard. Just how,
well, now that you put it that way, I made it seem that way. I agree with you now. I'm out. That's it. I'm out.
Well, I mean, I remember like having a case when I knew nothing, and it was like, you know, two young boys who were living with, you know, two young parents who were meth addicts, and, you know, they'd have porn on the TV. So the two young kids are acting out porn scenes, and it's just like, and I was supposed to see the boys like for play therapy. And it's like, I'm not going to affect any change by doing play therapy with the boys at any meaningful level.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a lot of times where I felt like I was just way out of my league. Like I remember also there was someone, I was in a school, and I think a 15-year-old girl came and was telling me about her alcoholic abusive dad who would come home in the middle of the night and rage. And I went to my supervisor and I said, you know, what do I tell her? Mm-hmm. And my supervisor was like, tell her to always make sure she has an exit. Like she can get out through a window or a door. Just like,
it's true.
Are you kidding me?
Like
it's true, but it leaves a lot to be desired.
Very true. It's a very simplistic answer to a very deep, complex.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, I think that's really the importance of having a very good clinical base supervisor. Like the supervisor that I have at the clinic I work at, I obsess over him. He has left recently to move on, but he's been in the business for like over 40 something years, practiced when Martin Luther King was assassinated, like just real life stuff. And the way he came across that to me is what helped me to have someone like that to turn to. And I, even now I text him once in a while, asking him questions, picking his brain, and having professors that you believe in and trust in to go back to and ask, and colleagues to pick their brains, because you don't know everything. And when cases come your way that are really that intense or really out of your wheelhouse, you're dealing with a human life and you need to be your best that you can. And so you got to get the help when you need it.
Well, and one of the things that I guess calmed me down a little bit when I was going through those stages was the realization of just how important it is to have someone listen to you for an hour a week, and period, just stop there. You know, I realized that very few people have that, where you get someone to just listen compassionately, objectively, non-judgmentally. And, you know, there was a philosopher a while back who had the idea that if we finally got the chance to tell our whole story without interruption, then we'd be free of it. And I think there's something really beautiful to that.
You know, the people that I work with, you know, even let's say the case that you were talking about the 15-year-old teenager with a alcoholic and abusive father, the idea of just having someone just care about you is probably not happening on a day-to-day basis from someone who's supposed to be loving and caring you. So to have that weekly moment to just understand and connect to something that is actually a human value and something so integral for your growth and success, you know, that's why when I have conversations with friends or colleagues, or when I'm posting things on social media and talking to people about the idea of therapy, that's what I try to describe it as. It's not this like Freud, sit on my couch, you know, let me get into your deepest, darkest secrets and make you cry and force you to have emotions. And let's really just delve deep. It's more about just having that moment to yourself to connect with a human being who actually cares about you and wants the best for you, which not everyone has in their life, which is extremely sad, but also pretty much a reality in a lot of people's worlds.
Yeah, definitely. So I think that's what I would kind of default to when I felt like I didn't know what I was doing or wasn't doing enough. Because I also think that I've had clients that are extremely depressed in the past, where I think part of the dynamic, the subconscious dynamic with someone that's really depressed, is they want you to feel just as hopeless and helpless as they do.
Yeah.
And at times I've gotten there, I'm like, I've thrown everything I have at this guy, and he's still like, nope, not going to work for me. Nope, that won't work for me. But then I remember that, you know, he may not have anyone else to talk to in his life, and I'm the one person per week.
And saying it that way, there was a moment where when I was in the psych unit, when I was working in the psych unit, and I said to my supervisor, like, this is not therapy. And she looked at me and she said, well, what do you think therapy is? And you know, in our vision in the movies and TV, we view therapy as sitting in the beautiful office, you know, with that, you know, person who's so stoic and has no emotions and is really just, and how does that make you feel? Tell me more. But in reality, therapy is really just two people connecting and just being objective and non-judgmental with someone and giving them that space to feel and be and grow and whatever that means for them. That's truly what therapy is. And that comes in many shapes and sizes. You know, in the psych unit where I worked at, I wasn't sitting in a nice fancy office. I was literally sitting in the middle of like a lobby with people half naked and someone else, you know, pooping on the floor and people were screaming and yelling and some people were quiet and reading and people were playing chess. It wasn't like the classic style of what you would envision as therapy.
That doesn't sound quite as glamorous.
No, not at all. Right. But that's what therapy was. It was me and this person connecting and helping and me helping them. And that's just the world that you have to reframe your process of what you actually view what therapy is. It comes in many ways.
No, I think of therapy, if we're going to media depictions, I think of therapy as Good Will Hunting, Robin Williams' character.
Oh,
it's not your fault,
scene.
Will. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. That scene.
I think that's one of the most more accurate. I feel one of the more accurate senses of what therapy truly is versus some of the other, like, I don't know if you watch that show. What is it with the devil, Lucifer? And they have a therapist and she crosses all these boundaries and all these like rules and regulations that no therapist would ever do. She sleeps with her clients. Yeah. She tells this person and tells that person, tells this person, and like breaks all the HIPAA laws. But like that thing with Good Will Hunting is just powerful to what a true therapist should be like.
Yeah. One of my favorite movies.
Oh, best movie. It's a great movie.
But you know, one of the things I was thinking as you were talking is it seems to me that, how do I put this? The more I think you're right that therapy can be anything from just sitting next to someone and listening, or even, you know, just sitting in silence potentially, as long as you're kind of caring and nurturing and compassionate, all the way up to, very detailed psychoeducational teaching and homework and reading books. And it seems to me, as I reflect on my career, you know, I used to do more of the former when I was younger, and now I do more of the latter. So I've shifted more to executive coaching. And so I've got higher functioning clients that can take on a lot more ideas, a lot more homework. And the beautiful thing about it is that they get a lot more as a result. So you can see the progress. It's very palpable.
And I think just my experience as a younger therapist, my clients who are more high functioning and more able to get into that place, I do see a lot more progress than the ones that are just more simplistic in the fact of just being there with them for an hour. Not that that's not any more or less important, but just the progress in their issues of what they're coming to therapy for. And I also think the fact that as being a more seasoned therapist, you gain more knowledge yourself of what tools and what resources you have in your toolbox that you're able to bring into therapy. That's unbelievable. You know?
Yeah. One of the things that strikes me again, as I look back on my career is, the difference in my ability to handle suicidal clients. Because I remember, you know, when I was starting out, if I had a client that was suicidal and, you know, actively suicidal with plans, it would follow me all week and it would weigh on me tremendously. And over time, I've gotten better at stepping back from that and caring appropriately, but knowing it's a really interesting practice in non-attachment that you have to know that there's nothing you can do in the hundreds of hours that the patient is outside of your office. Mm-hmm. And the only time you have some influence is when they're sitting there with you for an hour.
I love that you said that. I was going to say that, you know, when I first started in the psych unit, and even with my supervisor that I love, Dr. Rustin, his name is Dr. Stanley Rustin. One of the things he said to me, because he said to me, he said, Ellie, you have no control. You need to realize you can be the best therapist, the most years under your belt, and do everything, quote unquote, perfectly right to the book, to the letter. And if they want to do something, they'll do something. You have to just put your best foot forward and realize that you're doing your best. And other than that, it's out of your hands, because you're right. The hours that they're outside of your office, you cannot control them. You cannot stop them. You cannot, even if you have a safety plan and you have their family involved and you have mobile crisis involved and you get an ACT team involved and all these other things that could be involved in the resources we have today, still, you still have no control. And that helped me, because it was so hard to kind of pull away sometimes, like you said. To like remove myself. Well, I think it's my responsibility.
Because we get into this profession because we care. We want to help people. Yeah. And then you get into these situations as a mental health care provider where you can't help.
Yeah.
And it really, it's really problematic. And it's funny to me, because I think one of the big tasks in getting into mental health is learning the ability to manage your own emotions much, much better.
Yeah. I love that. It's so true, because it really tests you as a person and an individual to see where you're at with your emotional health and your emotional regulation, to be able to keep your cool or to de-stress after a long stressful day or a bad session, quote unquote, or a hard session. It's a very, very amazing eye opener. And also for me as a therapist, sometimes I come out of sessions and I appreciate my life so much more. like it also gives me perspective on my life as a human being.
Yeah.
And the hard time someone's having. And sometimes, you know, even though this is not a joking matter, but even after, let's say, a terrible couple session, I'll come out and I'll go home and I give my wife a huge hug and kiss because I appreciate, it's like, I appreciate the relationship we have. It's not perfect. It's not amazing, but you have no idea what I just dealt with. Like, you just don't know. And I'm not going to start divulging and telling you, but like, it just gives you this moment of this like meta moment of taking a step back and looking at your life and going, wow, this is amazing what I have.
No, I think you're absolutely right that one of the things our profession is good for is gratitude via perspective.
Yeah.
And it sure gives you, every day I come home with perspective. There's somewhere else I was going to go with that. Oh, I know. Have you ever, so how long have you been doing this? 3-4 years?
3 years.
Okay.
A little over 3 years.
Reading, school?
It would be about 6 years, 6 to 7 years.
Okay. So.
Oh, wow.
Don't feel so young now, do you?
No, I do not.
You're a baby. You're so young. Your whole life's in front of you.
I'm very excited.
So let me, I have a question to ask you, but I'll preface it with a story so you can have time to think of how you want to answer the question, which you will discern from my story. So I remember when I was new and starting out in this field that one of the things that kind of overtook me was that idea of emotions are contagious and you can pick them up from other people. And so seeing, you know, too many clients in a week where their stories were filled with anger, fear, sadness, guilt, shame, I was picking them up without much awareness and no one had taught me how to protect myself against that. It ended up with me getting depressed. So have you found that in yourself? Have you struggled at times with the training, profession, the weight of it?
I think it's sometimes like I can feel my shoulders kind of rising up after a long or intense day. I think it does depend on the day and the clients that I deal with and the struggles that they're going through. But I would say that I happen to be just a very self-aware person and very insightful to what I need. I'm not always perfect and not always great at it, but it's something that is a strength of mine. So what I have what I call like a coping card for myself, or a list of things in my head that I know that if I start feeling a certain way, whether it's I become angrier or more anxious or more stressed, or even down or depressed, in some ways, that I know I can rely on these 3 or 4 things to kind of pull me out or give me kind of a sense of self-care or detachment from my work. Whether it's like on the ride home from work, I play classical music. It's my brain's way. It's my way of turning my brain off and triggering. It's now time to go home. It's now time to get back into husband mode, father mode, you know, parent mode, whatever it is. But it doesn't always work. And it does rub off sometimes, which is why the classic thing, oh, you're a therapist. You must go to therapy. Yeah, because it's really hard work. And it's really, it takes a toll on you. It's very taxing. But at the same time, as a therapist, it's very important to take care of yourself so that you can be okay for your life, because your work can end tomorrow. You can quit your job and all that stuff, but you still have to live with yourself and how that stuff impacts you. So 100% it can, but I've worked very hard to find like my little things that help me.
So what else is on that coping card?
Music is one of the biggest ones for me, depending on my mood. It could be classical music, could be rap, it could be rock, it could be Billy Joel, Dave Matthews. I'm not a big country music fan. No, I'm not trying to be a hater. It's not one of my things. But I do have those like playlists that I kind of go to. One of them is reading. I love to read, specifically nonfiction books. My family is a big self-care for me. I love tea. I love tea. I'm a big tea snob. And so that for me is also something that kind of helps calm me down. And the one thing that I think is a lot across a lot of people is working out or moving or something of that nature, just to get it out and sweat it out a little bit.
Yeah. I'm wondering how to remarket or rebrand self-care for men.
I don't know. I'll call it, something cool or something like
man stuff,
man stuff. The man.
We all need it. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I'll do exercise, maybe yoga, maybe stretching, deep breathing, hang out with loved ones.
I think men do that, by the way. I think men do it. I think people do it and don't even realize that's what it's called. Like when you go on a mini vacation or staycation for a couple of days, that is what you're doing. It's not, you're calling it something, but really it's just taking care of yourself. Or if it's hanging out with friends or your buddies or family or watching a sports game or just chilling on the couch and just taking a couple of minutes to scroll through social media. Those things are self-care tools that we just don't put words to, and we just think it's our daily life. Well,
if social media actually makes you feel better.
Yes. Yes. That's another point, a whole nother conversation and podcast about social media and its effect on us.
Yeah.
It's a whole world of its own.
So one of the places that I wanted to get to with you, this is kind of taking a right turn, so I talk a lot about masculinity on here and kind
Which
of
I
what
love.
It means for people to be a man.
I love.
And I know you told me last time that you were raised as an Orthodox Jew.
Yeah.
In the city, right? In New York?
In Long Island. I'm a Long Island guy.
So what's that like? Like, what lessons do you learn about being a man in that environment? Because I have nothing to compare it to.
I love, like I told you before this call, I love this question. I think it's so important to see how cultures and religions and different faiths and beliefs and where you come from impact your view on masculinity and gender as a whole. And I would say this, there is a misconception about the Jewish community that I've seen. I am not an ultra-Orthodox Jew. I am not Hasidic. I am not in that world. I am a modern Orthodox Jew, which means I believe in the secular world and the religious world. The fact that I have a job and I work and I watch TV and I drive and I do things. I went to school and learned English and regular studies. I'm a modern Orthodox Jew, which means those things. It's a really weird box in terms, but there's a bad rep of the ultra-Orthodox community that the Jewish community is only focused on the men, not on the women. I learned a very balanced life. My mother was the household. She was everything. She ran the household. She was the one who was the values and the ethics and the morals and teaching us how to live a good, full life. And my father was there by her side as well. And I think it really depends on the family and your father and your and the men in your life. But for me, the men that I was around, my brother, my cousins, my uncles, and the Jewish community that I grew up in, valued an idea of mixed, whether it was being a man's man, right? Or being a very emotional, in touch man. And honestly, I didn't learn it from my religion. It has nothing to do actually with the religious side of it. It had to do with men in general. But I think there is a religious component of this idea of what the father role is, what is regarding education of Judaism and education and going to synagogue and the rituals and the practices versus the mother, who's more of this spiritual versus the letter of the law, but more of the spirit of the law, and kind of creates that environment in the home. So I guess it really I love the question because it makes me really rethink and look back on what I was taught. But yeah, it's interesting times. It's a great question.
Well, and one of the things that I really respect about Judaism is the encouragement of questioning.
Yes.
And so if I take that from Judaism, if I'm you, and apply it to masculinity, I think it does promote a healthy dose of permission to question.
Always.
What does it mean to be a man?
Always. I was always allowed to ask questions. I was never shot down by anyone in my family or friends. I was never shot down by a rabbinic or rabbi figure or teacher. It depends on who you ask, of course. You're going to get good ones and bad, you know, good eggs and bad eggs. But what I would say is that the Passover holiday or the Talmud, which is passed down orally from one generation to generation, which is now written down centuries ago, the whole thing is questions. The whole concept of it is asking and re-asking, analyzing and thinking and rethinking, because that's what it's about. You should not take life for granted. You should not take anything for granted, no matter who you're taught it by and who passes it on to you, but to think for yourself and to have the freedom to ask and search and find what your truth is, I think is one of the, I love that you pointed it out. People don't really see that very often. That's one of the integral parts of the Jewish faith, is asking and searching and having the freedom to do that.
Yeah, and the closest I've seen, and I don't consider myself a world religion expert, but the closest I've come to that is in something like Buddhism, where, you know, I know that the Dalai Lama, His Holiness, has said that if he's encouraged the intersection of Buddhism and science and said, mm-hmm. you know, he has offered some of his monks to come over to the West mm-hmm. to be used or to have research done on them. And yeah. he said, if science overturns any of the basic tenets in Buddhism, I will change Buddhism. That's Love a similar that. Dynamic there, right? And quite profoundly different from
anything yeah, I've you heard know, most there's a misconception that like the Jewish laws are very strict and like constricted to the well, back in the day we did this, but things advance just like the world. So one of the big examples I always use is like even electricity, right? The laws and regulations of how to use electricity on the Sabbath or on holidays, that wasn't a concept before. And then they had to just work around it and see how it applied and adjust and readjust and ask and wonder and think. It's a beautiful thing to progress and grow. And there are a lot of arguments over that and what progression, how much progression should we do, right? Which is most, even politically, right, that comes into play. It's just everything, right? How much do you push the boundaries and how much do you stick to the old versus the new? And I think it's a very fun times and also can cause a lot of stress for a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes me think of, there was a novel that I read back in college, and I can't remember the novel. I believe it was J.D. Salinger, but I can't find it. Okay. But it was this idea of, it was a story about this really intelligent family. So there's two parents and five kids. And the way they made their money to live on was they went on a game show. And this game show, they would just consistently win. They were like the biggest, you know, winners of all time kind mm-hmm. of a thing. And the parents gave all of their children permission to be whatever religion they wanted to be after studying every world religion.
I would love to know what that book was.
At a dinner table, they'd have a Jew next to a Christian, next to a Lutheran, next to a Hindu, next to a Buddhist, and they would have these crazy religious conversations. And I've always loved that idea. And I think it inspired me to just look at all of the world religions with an open mind and just figure, what are some of the commonalities here? What can I pull from them? Because it never made sense to me to have an all-knowing, you know, omnipresent, omniscient God that would put down one figure in one part of the world and say, this is the way to truth. You have to go through this person to get the truth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes much more sense if I'm all-knowing to put culturally relevant icons, sprinkle them throughout the world. And yeah, okay, maybe the messages differ a little bit and they get, you know, a little bit twisted. But I mean, so because it never made sense to me that nobody in China could go to heaven because they didn't know about Jesus, you know, because they never were introduced to him. That. It just doesn't make any sense.
I love that. And you know, I might be like an outlier or not what a lot of other people believe. But like I said, I'm more of a modern Orthodox Jew and I'm very open to these kind of conversations. I love that because I think there's truth and honesty and lessons from every walk of life, every person, every culture, every religion, which makes life so interesting. And to say that one person is better or less than or wrong or right, it just denies you of learning from someone and something, which can open your eyes to something so amazing and wonderful. It doesn't mean you have to all of a sudden buy in or believe or throw everything you knew out the window and leave everything in your past, but it just makes you more of a broader, fuller person, which I think makes you human. And I think that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, thank you for going there with me.
I love that question.
So where else would you like to go? When we were talking before, we were talking about men's development.
Yeah.
And what do you see in New York City? I mean, well, here, let me go here. So when you were growing up, what kind of school did you go to? Did you go to public school?
I did not. I went to a private Jewish school.
And so did you get, and this is kind of a hard question to answer, to what extent did you have a similar experience that you might have gotten into public school? And by, I guess I'm leading the witness. So, I mean, I'm thinking of when I was a kid, you know, we would get things of, you know, don't be a bitch, don't be a little girl, don't be a pussy, don't be so gay, you know, that kind of stuff. And then not all the time, but it didn't take many times for me to learn those lessons you know, from being told that. Yeah. Did you get stuff like that?
100%. You know, teens and kids are teens and kids, whether it's, you know, Judaism, Christianity, or a public school that has no denomination, right? And I was called gay all the time as a kid because I was in like a boys group. I sang in a boys group that traveled. And then if you weren't good enough in sports, you know, then that throws you under the bus. And now you must be gay, right? And this idea of looking at you or dressing a certain way or doing your hair or what you brought in for lunch. Just stupidity. That crosses all boundaries of how people look at men and treat men and talk about what it means to be a man was constant and always, and something that still goes on today in my life, depending on who and what and where you are, which I think is just a little overdone, you know?
Just a little. But I mean, the reason I asked that question is because I'm trying to find out what are the boundaries of the cultural differences, because I'm pretty sure it's the same or similar throughout the U.S. But I wasn't sure, like in, you know, in TV, Orthodox Judaism, maybe
TV is a TV, right? You learn things from the TV, you learn things from the media, you learn things from the news.
So, but I'm trying to figure out, like, is it the same in China? Is it
Same that's a great Japan? Question.
Is it the same in the Philippines or New Zealand? And I think one of the things I know is that there are a couple of cultures where it is not like that. And those cultures are typically island bound, and they they're not short on resources. Mm-hmm. The theory is that if we're short on resources and we are next to some neighbors that could invade us, that we need a soldiering force. And so we need to bring up our young men as stoic, you know, ignore your pain, be aggressive. Wow. And the men in these cultures are not anything like the men in our man box cultures. They're, you know, like in Samoa, it's very nurturing to cook for your family. It's manly. Mm. It's masculine to take care of the family.
Mm, I love that. And you know, when I was a kid, when I was about to go into high school, we had like a parlor meeting, I guess, in someone's home about the high school, and people from the incoming ninth grade class were sitting with the principal and their parents and just discussing the year to come. And a friend of mine, my best friend still today, asked if he could have a cooking club because he loved cooking. So do I. I love cooking for my family. I enjoy it. I find it relaxing. I hate cleaning like everyone else does. But I love cooking the food and making, you know, that's my connection of love. Like I'm feeding you. I want to reach to you. And he was called gay for like the next 2 years. Oh, what? You want to be in the kitchen? Like, oh, but it doesn't make sense. And you know what? Now he's an unbelievable cook and I would eat anything he made and I would do it then, you know, and his mother's an amazing cook and his father's a great cook too. And you know, it doesn't make a difference. But the fact that you say that, and that example just pops in my head, because it's so interesting that in certain cultures, and I would love to read research on that and just ideas about that, because it's so interesting.
Oh, I've got all sorts right now.
I can't wait to hear it and see it. But like the idea of how culture defines the roles of the boxes we're put in and how that plays into when you kind of just veer out of that box just a little bit, how you're then viewed. And it's just sad sometimes. It's really sad to see the pain it can cause.
And, you know, I was talking to Ron Levant, I don't know, last week, and he's like, he was former president of the APA and like one of the leading authorities on masculinity. And I totally forgot where I was going with that.
The box.
Hold on, it'll come back to me.
Okay, we'll get it.
The boxes were put in. I don't know. Let me note this down here. 4133. Edit that out. I rarely have to do that. what was Ron saying? Oh, I know. So Ron was saying that there's a difference between one of the fundamental differences to make is between sex and gender. Where, you know, I was born male as defined by my physical hardware.
Yeah.
And my gender is I tend towards masculinity. And that, he says, it's socially dictated. And it's interesting to me 100%. Because not everyone believes that. And I think there's a big difference if you believe masculinity is nature versus nurture. Mm-hmm. And I just remember having a client that was gay a while back and his parents were not into it at all. And we're trying to look up what are some of the, what's the mindset about homosexuality where you just are homophobic? And yeah. what it comes down to primarily is, do you believe it's nature or nurture?
Mm.
If you believe it's a choice, you're virulently homophobic, most people. Mm. If you believe it's nature and you're born that way, you're more accepting of it.
Interesting. That's so amazing.
And I think that so masculinity is really, it's a close parallel.
Yeah. And I love that idea, that the idea of, you know, as you know, I am born a male and I identify as a male. And regarding my gender, I am more in the middle. Regarding, I sometimes can be more feminine when it comes to my emotions and mm-hmm. the way I describe or talk about things and the way I feel certain things, but doesn't mean I'm any less a man mm-hmm. when it comes to how I identify or my sex. And I think there is this misconception that goes into, if you do X, Y, and Z, then you're just not manly enough. If you don't fit into the box that's defined by society, like if you don't like sports or if you don't like cars and manly things and you are not good with your hands and regarding construction and you don't work out, you're not a muscle builder, then you're just not manly enough.
Yeah.
But for me, being manly is being with my family, being a good dad, being a good husband, you know, being a quality human being. To me, that makes me, I feel manly. Yeah. You know, would I love to have a six pack and crazy muscles? Of course. But if I don't, am I any less of a man? No, yeah. It just means I look better on the beach. Cool. Great. You know?
Well, and I think the problem with that masculinity, like that whole mindset of you're masculine or not masculine enough, is that it's so hard won and so easily lost. And even those guys that are the, you know, hardline subscribers to traditional masculine ideology, those guys are going to age. And at a certain point, they're going to have a real big identity crisis where they're going to lose their musculature, or at least some of it.
Yeah.
Their body is going to betray them due to age. You know, back goes out, neck goes out, hands don't work as well. And then, you know, you run into this idea of, are you still a man?
Mm-hmm.
Which is a silly question. But for those guys, it's a problem.
Yeah. And that's what I think where like the midlife crisis comes into, specifically for men, the idea of what we see in society as like buying that crazy car, doing those like really intense, ridiculous things. Cause I think it's just them trying to reinforce the idea of, I still got it. Like I'm still with it and I can prove my ego, my manlyhood by doing X, Y, and Z. And I think, you know, when we talked last about Lewis House's book on the masks of masculinity. Mm-hmm. And he puts like these categories for men in these like personas that they identify as, whether it's sports, money, automobiles, women, your sex, how much sex you've toughness. Had and how you've had it and then physical yeah. toughness, mental toughness, you know, all those little things that we kind of put ourselves in the boxes we define ourselves out. But sometimes they go away, like you said, and then what? Then what? What do you do? What are you not yeah. any less or any more of a man because you can't walk or your back went out?
It's,
you know,
it's interesting.
Ridiculous.
So I'm going to be very transparent here. I've not copped to this on this podcast, so a little hesitant. But I remember, so after I got divorced, I got a vasectomy mm-hmm. because I was like, I don't want to take any chances. I've got four kids. I don't need any more. And it was the weirdest thing because for about a day after I got the vasectomy, I had these thoughts come up of, am I any less of a man because now I've got no sperm?
Yeah. That's a great point. And thank you so much for sharing that and doing that. But you know, even people, let's say who have prostate cancer and they have to remove their prostate and they might not be able to be as high functioning in the bedroom. All of a sudden they're like, well, I'm not manly enough anymore. My manhood is yeah. taken away. Because I think there is like this cultural thing, and it could go back generations and centuries, the idea of genitals and the idea of the power and what that represents.
Breeding.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Having a son.
You know, and when my wife and I, we went through infertility, and the idea of me not being able to produce the well, perfect sperm to impregnate my wife, that made me feel less like a man.
Mm-hmm.
I was not doing my part as the man in the equation. And I felt, well, what am I doing then? I'm not man enough. So yeah. It's just an interesting thing how that's connected a lot.
And that thought of, I am not man enough, man, that messes with you. I mean, it just, it undercuts everything.
Yeah.
Like nothing else really matters if you're not man enough. But yeah, the other thing that crosses my mind now, I'm just riffing. But I've been having these PTSD flashbacks, I guess, I don't know, to like middle school. And I remember there was things, maybe it was elementary school. They were saying like, you know, how do you check if you've got, I don't know, crap on your shoe. Mm-hmm. And there's two ways to look at your shoe. One is you pull your shoe up in the front of you. The other is you put the shoe behind you, the leg behind you, and look over your shoulder. Well, the joke was, or I don't know, the thinking was at that time, if you pulled your leg up in front of you, you're gay, because that's how girls do it. Versus, oh, it's behind you. Okay, cool. You're a guy. And the other thing they did, how do you check your nails?
But that was yes, I was just like, going to say that.
How do you tell if you have a hang nail?
I was just going to say that. This way or that way.
Or this way. Yeah. And so, yeah, I guess girls do it this way. And then they would make fun of you for that. And it's a 50-50 shot. You're like, oh, I know the stakes for this are high, but I'm not sure which way to go. I know I'm going to get fucked for going the wrong way on this.
It's been one question of how I look at my nails or how I look at my shoe. It's true. It's so true. And kids stick to that and they go with it and they grapple on, and that either can break someone or people use that as ammo for the rest of ridiculous for years. Remember that time where you looked at a shoe? Oh, you're so gay. Like, what? That doesn't mean anything. That doesn't equal. But we have these like preconceived notions of, well, that's feminine, that's masculine. So if you do X, Y, and Z, then that's masculine, and the other thing is feminine, and you can't. And that's not okay. And we're gonna make fun of you for it.
One of the ideas I'm trying to promulgate, I think that's the right word, to share.
Sounds good.
Is this idea of, you know, that there's multiple ways to be masculine. It's not just one ideal that we see in the movies that, yeah, okay, you can do that if that's what you want. I would say you probably need the ability to shift gears out of that to fit certain situations better. It's not always the best mask to be wearing. But, you know, I think that just that idea and understanding that there are hundreds of ways to rightfully be a man, and that the better we are at accepting all of those, the less traumatized everyone's going to be. Because I really look back at childhood and I think, how did any of us survive childhood without trauma from, you know, fist fights and name calling and trying to prove ourselves as a man and the stupid shit we used to do?
Totally.
I don't know.
And it's a great point, you know, that when you look back, and even today, you might make certain decisions or thoughts or concepts that you're just not sure if you should or shouldn't do, because will this take away from my manhood? And that line of thinking is so pervasive and so negative and so destructive. But it started when you were younger, when people started pointing out those things. It didn't just all of a sudden pop into your head.
It starts at four, at the age of four. And well, so Ron Levan was telling me that, so when they do research on babies as boys and girls, and for the first year of life, boys are more emotional, more expressive than girls.
Yeah.
They cry louder, they cry longer.
Yeah.
And if you ask the moms to name what their child is feeling, the moms are really good at it for both sons and daughters up till the age of about five or six. And then this gap between the moms and the sons starts to appear. And the gap happens exactly when they start preschool or kindergarten, when they start being exposed to peers more frequently.
And the comparisons and the...
And that's because they start shutting down themselves emotionally.
Oh, that's amazing. It's amazing. And
that's early.
That's early. That's really early. And I've noticed that, whether it's people I've worked with or just my own life or my nieces and nephews and friends or little ones where I was, you know, a counselor in camp and stuff like that. You can see it at a really young age, the division that happens and the clear line that's made between masculine and feminine and what is accepted and not in each circle. Whether it's the knapsack you have or backpack, wherever you're from, or, the hat you wear or the colors you wear. Like, I could care less personally if my daughter wears blue. I could care less. It doesn't make a difference to me. You know, if she wants to play with this toy or that. She was playing with Shrek yesterday. Oh, no. There you go. That's it. It's over. It makes no difference to me. She's happy. She's wonderful. She's loving. She's cute and adorable. Great. But you can see a line. Like you said, I now that you put it that way, like at like preschool or kindergarten, where these conversations and circles are created in the society of that school group. It's so interesting.
The other thing that kind of, this is a little tangential, but it makes me think, you know, there's talking with sex experts, there's this epidemic of erectile dysfunction among 20 something men. Mm. And, you know, most people attribute it to a heavy use of porn. But, you know, that's another one where anything I think related to your penis, your dick, is going to be closely tied into your sense of masculinity. So if you can't get it up, or even if you can't finish when you're having sex, like that's going to, my imagine is that's going to be closely tied into your sense of masculinity, like, as well.
The idea of shame and embarrassment.
Yeah. And that's the problem with it. There's so many ways that your masculinity can go down the drain. There's so many ways you can go wrong. You can go wrong by looking at your nails in the wrong way, or looking at the sole of your shoe in the wrong way. I mean, there's so many ways that people are trying to take it away from you with shame. I think the biggest, you know, hammer is shame that we use, and we police ourselves. We're really good at policing ourselves.
Yeah. And I think also the fact that we define it with shame.
Yeah.
Instead of defining, let's say, for example, not being able to finish or produce in the bedroom as a biological thing, you know, you're not in the right mindset, stress, whatever it could be, versus, oh, damn it. Like, I'm not manly. Like, that's the first thought versus it being other reasons. And I think it's so, like I said before, it just can really bleed into every little thing that we do. And it's not saying that men versus women, this is not the conversation. This is just as men, and the idea of masculinity is really just if it's put into a box. If you're in this box, you're good. If you're not, you should be ashamed of yourself.
Yeah.
Which is just not a great way.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I don't know. That's some of the stuff I've been thinking about lately.
Well, I love that stuff you're thinking about. It's great.
Oh, thanks. I mean, I really do think that how we're socialized undercuts our shot at happiness. Because it undercuts our relationship with ourself. We're emotionally unaware. Mm-hmm. It undercuts our relationship with others, primarily our spouse.
Yeah.
Because the biggest complaint I hear from women is, I can't connect with my husband. Mm-hmm. I think it undercuts our ability to find meaningful work, because we buy into the notion that we're supposed to be the provider, and to be the provider means to make as much money as you can. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is it undercuts our relationship with something bigger than ourselves, which could be volunteering, but more often is religion and God.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, some research that I've come across that women are more religious than men. That women are the ones that drive the religiosity in the household.
They do. It's the truth. It's the truth. Wow. It's great. It's great
stuff. So all we have to do is change that.
Yep. Not a big deal. We got this.
Exhale. Well, Ellie, I got to say, you know, thank you for the conversation. It was a great and fascinating conversation. I enjoyed it. Anything else that you want to add, or how can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, of course. So you can get in touch with me through social media on Instagram at @elevation_therapist. You can check out my new podcast, The Dude Therapist, or on my website, elevation.org, where I have blogs and all the podcast posts. So reach out whenever you want, get in touch. Just try to work very hard to normalize and make mental health a little more digestible for the masses, you know?
Awesome. We need more of that. Is your podcast on all the platforms?
Everything possible. Probably forget half the things that, and now it's on Amazon Music. Amazon Music just came out with podcasts.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to be on the front end of that one.
Yeah.
Good job.
So all the regular things, Apple, iHeartRadio, Spotify, all those things, Google.
Well, Ellie, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Greatly enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
All right. And that is it for this episode.